So we're talking about resistance today, which is just a great thing to talk about in the middle of the summer. My actual title was Resistance is Fertile, because I thought I was being funny, but it got edited down to just Resistance. So there was some hesitancy to embrace that title. Does anybody know what that relates to? Star Trek, yeah. The Borg, right? Awesome. Okay. So what are some of the associations we have with the word resistance when you just think about it? What comes to mind? Circuitry. Oh, yeah. I like it. So it's like an electrical analogy. Yeah. I don't know anything about electricity. I just know it's related to that, so I'm going to stop. Any other associations that come up when you think of resistance, having resistance? Fear? What's that? The Daleks. Nice. Nice. Doctor Who and Star Trek. Could it get any better? Yeah, any others? Sorry. Rebellion? Uh-huh. Star Wars? There you go. Let's just get them all out there. Any positive associations with, not that those are negative, a lot of them are positive. Political movement, yeah. Setting boundaries, yeah. You feel some resistance maybe to something or someone that's unhealthy. Yeah, so I think we have kind of a mixture of associations that come up for us when we think about that word resistance. Some of them are favorable. Some of them are less than. And so today, we're going to look at resistance as that which keeps us from moving toward God and moving toward our life's work. So that's kind of the definition I want to work with today. And we're going to be drawing from a few quotes today. Some of y'all may be familiar with Stephen Pressfield's The War of Art. You may like it, you may not like it. But I'm going to draw a few quotes today, and that's going to be part of our looking at Moses' life, actually, as well. So let me start us off with this quote, where Pressfield says, "Most of us have two lives, the life we live and the end of it, and the unlived life within us. Between the two stands resistance. Have you ever brought home a treadmill and let it gather dust? Ever quit a diet, a course of yoga, a meditation practice? Have you ever bailed out on a call to embark upon a spiritual practice? Never. Dedicated yourself to a humanitarian calling, committed your life to the service of others. Have you ever wanted to be a mother, a doctor, an advocate of the weak and helpless, to run for office, crusade for the planet, campaign for world peace, or to preserve the environment? Late at night, you've experienced a vision of the person you might become, the work you could accomplish, the realized being you were meant to be. Are you a writer who doesn't write? A painter who doesn't paint? An entrepreneur who never starts a venture? Then you know what resistance is." So let me just start off by saying that I disagree with Pressfield in some ways. And I want to suggest that his work, this is a great little book, actually, just if you need like a kick in the butt for motivation or something, it's a great, great little read. But I disagree with the impression that the book gives, and maybe these quotes today might even give as well, that we should always be creating, that we should always be producing something. And if we're not, then whenever we're not, that's not meaningful. So I just want to kind of start off and just kind of push on that a little bit and say we're going to pepper that in a little bit, but it doesn't mean everything else is meaningless. And yet, when we are being called to and by God, there is a force that often impairs our ability to respond. And in those times, I think Pressfield actually helps and kind of nails what resistance is. And today we're going to see that Moses' life had seasons to it. He had seasons of displacement, seasons of threat, of stability, and then seasons of dramatic change. He had a very reluctant and avoidant relationship with God. And our story today actually picks up with Moses being called out of a season of stability. Like he's been in a very good season in his life in some ways compared to what it was before. And his response to this is one of dramatic resistance. So we pick up today with Moses having a conversation with God via a shrub that is on fire, but it is not burning up. And our text today is focused on Moses' protest to God's invitation to lead the Israelites out of slavery. So I invite you to read aloud together, as is our custom, Exodus chapter 4, verses 1 through 17. So right out of the gate, we see that resistance is a fan of the status quo, the norm. And I want to just back up a half step. I'm going to read to you a little bit of what comes right before this. So this is right after God asks Moses to do this. So God appears, and then God says, Moses, I want you to lead my people out of slavery. And in chapter 3, verse 11, but Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And God said, I will be with you, and this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. Moses said to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? Then what shall I tell them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, say to the Israelites, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. So resistance likes what's familiar. And for Moses, it takes the form of these two questions. The first one is, he just says, but who am I? And the answer is Moses, just a little backdrop, he was an orphan. I think he was orphaned at like 3 months. He was held kind of he grew up, I guess, among his enemies, among his captors. At age 40, he saw one of his kinsmen being abused, and he killed that person. And then he took off. He fled for his life. He settles down at the age of 40. He leaves and settles down to herd sheep and starts a family. And he does this for about 40 years. So you could imagine that maybe he's grown used to that. Like, this is his life now. He's a shepherd. And you can imagine at 80, when God says, hey, all right, I want you to use that leadership gift you have. He might not be like, all right, you know, super excited to root up his family and walk, I don't know, maybe 150, 200 miles. It was pretty far from Midian back to Egypt. And he asks, who am I? I'm a shepherd now. And I think it's common to mistake what we're currently doing or what we've done for a really long time with who we are. I think, in fact, sometimes it's even common to mistake our calling for who we are. And those things are doing, it flows out of who we are, but they don't have the power to tell us who we are. And we get that backwards a lot, at least I do. So this is not actually a helpful compass when we're trying to figure out what we're meant to do. And I think Moses is actually probably a born leader, and probably one of the most resistant leaders in human history. Could you imagine a leadership book written with Moses' life as the case study? So the first 40 years, I'm just going to take a stab at it. And if anybody's a writer, you can use all of this if you want. The first 40 years you live and work for your enemies. So this is how I imagine it. Please don't get offended. It might be like if you were more conservative to go work for Jon Stewart on The Daily Show, or if you're more progressive to go work for Bill O'Reilly at Fox News. And then at 40, you know, so Moses kills someone, so you're probably not going to sell many books maybe you just run away or you do something to get fired. So just do something stupid. Don't kill anybody. And then you run away. Take a little break. You know, Moses took 40 years off. So just go do something that has nothing to do with what you care about. I think we call it, would this be curating now? I'm trying to figure out what that word means because I hear it so much now. And the wordies out there are not happy. If you try to figure out the definition of curate, the way it's used now doesn't come up. So it's kind of fun, though, to play with. And so then you just wait there for instructions from talking plant life that's on fire. So in the book, you wait for a dramatic sign. That would be the translation. And then you just trust it over and over again. No, that wasn't really a miracle. And then reluctantly, exhausted of excuses, you agree. But you complain the whole time. Why do I have to be a leader? Why do I have to lead you people that complain all the time? And then you just ask, who am I? Who am I? So that's Moses on leadership. It's weird. There's no leadership books on him. So strangely enough, Moses' doubt, though, is actually more helpful than what he's done thus far in his life. In fact, Pressfield says it this way, self-doubt can be an ally. This is because it serves as an indicator of aspiration. It reflects love of something we dream of doing and desire to do it. If you find yourself asking yourself and your friends, am I really a writer? Am I really an artist? Chances are you are. The counterfeit innovator is wildly self-confident. The real one is scared to death. I think Tim came up and said, are you nervous? Like right before I got up, I was like, yeah. He's like, wow, does that ever go away? I don't know. So I want to also say, though, for some of us who've grown up in church, this is not anti-desire theology. So many of us have been taught there's nothing in us but darkness, which I think is not biblical, actually, and I'd be glad to talk to you about it, or talk with you, not to you. And all of our, you know, so in that theology, all of our desires are the opposite of God. So if you want to figure out what God's will is, just figure out what you really want and just do the opposite of it. Which then I think maybe that's why there's a lot of missionaries in places they just don't want to be. I don't know. That's probably not fair and oversimplistic. But you get the point. And that's the formula, actually, that happens. And I've heard it over and over growing up in churches. And you don't actually need God to figure out what your path is. If God is just this formulaic antithesis of what we really want, that doesn't require God. So this isn't what we're talking about, because resistance comes when we surface our most authentic desires, when we really connect with the deepest things, the deepest stirrings in us, and we give them space rather than reject them. And I think Moses was actually a born leader, but I think for him it's so scary that it takes God showing up in this dramatic way to get him to even consider this possibility. And even then, that may not be enough for Moses. He also asks, who are you, God? Like, who should I say is even sending me? Because by many accounts, Moses has had a rough life. And I think when we've had a lot of hard things happen, it's easy to assume either one, there is no God, or two, God doesn't really care. And so he's 80 now. He's 80 years old. Can you imagine? Like, we can't imagine, most of us in here. But how hard would it be to trust God if you felt like that wasn't a part of your life for so long? And I think Moses' reluctance is actually really honest. Like, I really admire it on a lot of levels. And I would venture to say he's not alone. One more quote. We're wrong if we think we're the only ones struggling with resistance. Everyone who has a body experiences resistance. And for many of us, our resistance actually takes the form of distrusting God. Like, that's one of the main things. And this is a problem because if we're going to disrupt the status quo, it often takes, like, supernatural support. Like, we need something other than what we have. Otherwise, we would have already done whatever it is we really want to do. So exploring and living into our deepest invitation would require God to be real. More than that, it would require God to be good and trustworthy. And so I want to suggest maybe starting with a smaller question this week, if you're kind of stirred by this a little bit, is maybe just thinking about, what is my status quo right now? Like, some of us, our status quo is change. Like, we love change, or we just seem to be having it all the time, whether we love it or not. Or for some of us, it's we're trying to keep things the same, and we're fighting so hard to kind of keep some sense of normalcy that we're getting exhausted. So the question is, when do I seek change or predictability instead of God? And then relationally, I think sometimes our status quo is one where we like completely throw our heart out there and it gets stomped on over and over again. Or we've had too much of that and our heart stays so far buried in us that we have trouble connecting. And so figuring out, how do I not overtrust, nor do I undertrust people in God? And what would it look like just to invite God into the struggle with the status quo? Like, would God be a teacher? Like, God, can you teach me what trust looks like? Can you teach me what it would be like to push into my resistance? Someone asked me recently why we have so many different animals, and we do. We have quite a few. I have a picture of one of the animals we have. We have weird animals. And I said about 2/3 of them, I want to say, are rescues. Like, they're actually legitimate. Like, people brought us animals, or, you know, someone's like, hey, the Minixes can't say no to animals. But about 1/4 to 1/3 of them are not. And so I always feel like I have to be honest when I tell the story. And basically, I try to be honest. 1/3 of the animals we have are a reflection of me flailing in my spiritual life. Which is not like the romantic answer people want to have. But I find that when I'm resisting, or I'm struggling with God, or I don't want to look at something, I'm trolling Craigslist. And all the animals we have can be found on Craigslist. Amazingly. We moved to where we were. We got a miniature donkey for $10. So there you go. So that's the emu. That's an emu, by the way. Sorry. I don't know if I said that. In fact, when friends ask me, like, how can they support me or be praying for me, I'll often tell them, just ask me if I've gotten any new animals. And that's how you'll know if I'm struggling or not. So having resistance can look like lots of different things. Is kind of my point. So maybe looking a little bit about how do we get tangled up with resistance. I think resistance focuses on the obstacles or minimizes them. In verse 1 of chapter 4, Moses answers, but what if they don't believe me or listen to me and say, the Lord did not appear to you? And then looking at verse 10, Moses resists again. He says to the Lord, pardon your servant, Lord, I have never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you have spoken to your servant. I am slow of speech and tongue. So he says, what if you don't believe me? What if they don't believe me? What if they call me crazy? You're not hearing God. You're probably, I don't know what schizophrenia would be then. Like, you're probably just, it's probably a fracture of your psyche or something like that. And that's not God. That didn't happen. You're delusional. You probably got dehydrated when you were out tending the sheep and stuff. You know, thought you saw that. And I think it's actually kind of a neat practical question. Like, Moses is very methodical. He's like, well, what about this, God? And what about that? And what about this? So God gives Moses his staff. He gives him the staff turning into a snake miracle. He has him put his hand in his coat and take it out, leprous. And to me, if God asked me to do that and said, I'm going to want you to do that again, I would want to like negotiate at that point and say, maybe like it would be more powerful if his hand became leprous and rather than mine. Yeah, why my hand? I mean, you know, but Moses maybe was coming along more trusting. If that doesn't work, he's like, let's pour some water in the river. It'll turn to blood. That'll get their attention. So Moses needed a bunch of like supports. He needed these things to bring with him. And even that wasn't enough. In verse 13, he says, pardon your servant, but please send someone else. This is too much. Moses maximizes every obstacle to the point of paralysis. Have you ever done that? It hits me in the morning. I'm like laying in bed thinking about, oh man, just thinking about the things I have to do. It's a lot easier just to stay in bed sometimes. I would also say resistance minimizes obstacles. I think a lot of times we get frustrated at, you know, if you're like a momentum person, you don't want to hear sentences that begin with, but what about this? Or have you thought about that? So if you're a momentum person, if you tend to not see the little potholes, which sometimes are gaping chasms, like, you probably need at least one person in your life who's asking you some questions and just see them as a gift to you. They're helpful. And then Moses goes on to resist again. He said to the Lord, I've never been eloquent, neither in the past, nor since you have spoken to your servant. I'm slow of speech and tongue. So by the way, you've probably been busy. You didn't notice this, but I really suck at public speaking. I'm imagining there's going to be a lot of it. And you know what? Since we started talking, that hasn't changed. I don't feel any different about it. I'm still going to stutter. I'm still going to struggle with it. So I kind of imagine, like, right, I would say I admire Moses because he's like, let's just put it on the table. And I think we could read that as reluctance, but I want to suggest he's being vulnerable. And this kind of openness, this kind of vulnerability actually creates the possibility of change. In fact, I think relationally, we come to the table with ultimatums like, love me this way or leave. It's like, you know, we have so little room for stretch. And so Moses doesn't do that, though. What he does is brings his resistance to the table. And I want to suggest this as a practice as well, that we consider practicing self-compassion. So what would that look like? Pick an area where you get stuck. Assume every bit of stuckness and floundering are there for good reason. Seek to understand this area you don't like as much, with as much kindness as you can muster, and then write out the most benevolent interpretation you can think of. What do we usually do when we feel stuck? We pick like the worst explanation, don't we? And then teach people how to have compassion for you. I had a relational epiphany a couple months ago. So Jenna and I, my wife, we were arguing, which rarely ever happens. We're good at it. And so I got my feelings hurt. I said, hey, I got my feelings hurt. I need an apology. Jenna was very sincere. She said, I'm really sorry. And then, like, she was ready for us to kind of feel close again. And I'm like, I'm not there yet. And she's like, see, why did I even bother? Like, you know, not like, why did I bother with you? But like, why did I, you know, it's like, okay, I did this. I put myself out there. It didn't even make a difference. So obviously you need something else. And what I realized actually was that actually it did. Like, I tried this. I said, what would compassion look like? What if I actually did receive the apology? What if I sincerely accepted it? And what I realized is my heart, like, closes really fast. Like, it's awesome at closing. But the opening part is, like, really slow. Slow heart opener. And I've met people that, like, they can open their heart like that. And I think, that's amazing. Like, how do you do that? And I'm fine, like, with other people. If they want to let me in, back in really quickly, I'm great with it. But when I get my feelings hurt, it takes me a while. And so what I found in that moment was that I just need you to hang in there with me a little bit. It's just going to take me a little bit longer. So I found, like, just practicing this compassion, is like, I suck at opening my heart up again. So I need you to just kind of hang in there with me. And I think that's part of what it means to kind of at times have that compassion, have a benevolent interpretation. Rather than go with this harsh judgment, assume maybe that resistance is there for a reason. You know, maybe our heart's been through a lot in life and it's just kind of beat up and it takes a while. And I think this, and I wonder if this isn't part of the back and forth Moses is having with God. His heart has been closed for so many years. It's not just going to reopen with a snap of fingers. It's going to take some time. And what's neat is God hangs in there. So let's look at God's response to this kind of last mile of this marathon of resistance. Resistance drains out of us with patient love. In verse 11, the Lord said to him, who gave human beings their mouths? Who makes them deaf or mute? Who gives them sight or makes them blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now go, I will help you speak and will teach you what to say. But Moses said, pardon your servant, Lord. Please send someone else. Then the Lord's anger burned against Moses, and he said, what about your brother Aaron, the Levite? I know he can speak well. He is already on his way to meet you, and he will be glad to see you. You shall speak to him and put words in his mouth. I will help both of you speak and will teach you what to do. He will speak to the people for you, and it will be as if he were your mouth and as if you were God to him. But take this staff in your hand so you can perform the signs with it." And then in verse 18, which isn't up there, Moses went back to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said to him, "Let me return to my own people in Egypt to see if any of them are still alive." So God kind of holds Moses' feet to the fire. Like, he's patient with the resistance. He gets a little angry with Moses, but he hangs in there with him. Moses is like, "I can't speak." And God's like, "I invented mouths. I know." It's like, imagine God with like this deep God sigh. You know. "Okay, how about we send your brother with you?" You know, Moses, the reluctance, it isn't a failure. It isn't a deal breaker. And I think true resistance actually can show us where to go at times. Pressfield says, "Resistance obstructs movement only from a lower sphere to a higher. It kicks in when we seek to pursue a calling in the arts, launch an innovative enterprise, or evolve to a higher station morally, ethically, and spiritually." So if you're in Calcutta working with Mother Teresa's Foundation and you're thinking of bolting to launch a career in telemarketing, relax. Resistance will give you a free pass. And yet we know there aren't any formulas in the spiritual life. I would say for some of us non-Moses types, our willingness to stay in a difficult job, to stay in a telemarketing job, actually could be God's call as well. You know, you look at Moses' life, he's 80. And it kind of pushes against this idea that every minute of every day I should be doing the thing I love. And I don't think that's what this is about. And that's what's beautiful about the story of Scripture, is this is a human life working it out. So even as we, you know, kind of stir the pot today a little bit, this isn't just trying to create discontent. It's trying to create an openness to where God is in our life and to hear that and to lean into that. And I want to say that verse 17 is actually my favorite verse in the passage. God says, "But take this staff in your hand so you can perform the signs with it." It's like, here's what I imagine. God's sending him off. You know, he's done all this work, and it's like God's sending him out the door to school. He's like, "Hey, don't forget your staff so you can perform the miracles." Like, "Hey, don't forget your lunch, honey. I think it's kind of fantastic." Like, then he reminds him. You know, I imagine him walking out and he forgot his staff. How's he going to do the miracles without the staff? And I just think there's so many little images of God's nurture, like God's nurturing presence as he walks with us in patience. So I want to close today. I think the poster child of resistance in the animal kingdom is probably the donkey. And I want to just close with a thought from a famous Christian mystic. "All day long, a little burro labors, sometimes with heavy loads on her back and sometimes just with worries about things that bother only burros. And worries, as we know, can be more exhausting than physical labor. Once in a while, a kind monk comes to her stable and brings a pair, but more than that, he looks into the burro's eyes and touches her ears, and for a few seconds the burro is free and even seems to laugh, because love does that. Love frees." I invite you to pray with me. God, we long for your touch. We long for your freedom. We long for our worries to be lifted. We long to be lighter, to be able to run freely, as children do at times. We long for you to look into our eyes with unfettered love, to taste and see that you're good, that in fact you exist, and that you're worthy of trust. So we pray you just meet us today as we bring our labored lives to your table. We pray this in the name of the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit. Amen.